Yeah, what a bloody weird day.
Yeah. I got a call from Wheeler yesterday, and it didn't really hit me until this morning.
I found out this morning, and had a little cry. Put my laundry out, saw the butterfly on the line, and then thought about the first time I'd ever met Robert, and then decided that I was going to actually just go to the pub and drink, sort of on my own, because nobody in Bristol really knew Robert.
Right.
And then I walked around the corner, and there was a clown called Palfy, who's an American guy.
Yeah.
That should have known Robert. He's a complete nutter. He's a Vietnam War vet. And then I went to the pub with him, and then bumped into Ian Cognito, nutty, hardcore, mad comedian person that Robert would have loved. And I just bumped into all these people that had never met Robert, but kind of should have. So yeah, it's been a weird day. I'm sort of meeting a lot of people that never knew him, and I'm enjoying trying to describe to them what a fucking bloke this was, you know, that I can do my job because of stuff that he's done beforehand, you know.
Yeah, he laid the foundation for so much.
Yeah.
Complete asshole at the right time.
Total asshole.
But only if you deserved it.
Only if you deserved it. I was talking to Bill Ferguson earlier, and I said to him, you know, Bill, you and me, you know, we're mouthy, you know, there's not many people that can stand up or will stand up to you and I, you know. And then Bill said, yeah, the annoying thing was that 2 or 3 hours after that discussion with Robert, you'd sit there and go, fuck, he was right as well. Anyway, I've set in motion this thing. I'm getting a tattoo of a butterfly down on the end of my knob.
Really? Do you have enough room?
Do I have room? Well, actually, it's going to be a caterpillar. Small one.
And then all you have to do is strap wings on and it becomes a butterfly, right?
Yeah, exactly. I kind of thought to myself that as he was winging his way upstairs to whatever lies off, you know, he put his toupee on to get through pearly gates, as it were.
Yeah, customs.
Yeah. And then as he meets the big man himself, off comes the toupee. Oh, fucking hell. Yeah, well, nice to talk to you. I've been making a point of just wanting to talk to as many people today that
that we can.
Yeah. Just want to talk to people that knew him, you know. Because we are so very, very lucky.
It matters not the job you've got.
The greatest icons of the street performing world.
As long as you do it well.
Never been so excited in my whole life.
Things that are made by plants well laid, the test of time will tell.
I knew I was going to get a little flack from each one of you.
You cannot count or know the amount.
I can do anything.
Or the value of a man by the show displayed or the beauty made by the touch of the juggler's hand.
Because no one really cares about me.
I am the Butterfly Man, and I thank you for your kind attention.
On August 27th, 2012, the busking world lost an icon when co-founder of the Busker Hall of Fame, Robert Nelson, the infamous Butterfly Man, passed away in his home in Pahoa, Hawaii. This podcast project wouldn't exist at all had it not been for Robert's willingness to take a stab at interviewing various characters from our world. Inevitably, he also ended up telling many of his own stories during these interviews, which ended up being more conversations with Robert than true interviews about whoever was being recorded. In the past few weeks, the staff of the Busker Hall of Fame has gone back to the original recordings to piece together the best of the moments when Robert talked about himself, his life, and some of the crazy antics he perpetrated during his legendary career. The volume of content we had to work with required us to break things up into several episodes, and today we present the first of these, an audio patchwork made up from several different recordings which shed some light on Robert's life leading up to becoming the Butterfly Man. Robert, you may be gone, but you're not forgotten.
Where did you grow up?
Well, my father, as you well know, was a doctor, and he got famous when I was very young. And so while I was born in Baltimore, I didn't live there very long. He was teaching at Johns Hopkins, and he invented this test for syphilis called the TPI test, which is also known as the Nelson test. And he got one of his 2 Nobel nominations for it. But he was only 26 at the time, so he was sort of a child prodigy. Anyway, they sent him on the road. We lived in Barcelona, we lived in Paris, and we lived in London, and then we moved back when I was about 8 to the United States. So I don't think I ever had a Spanish accent because we weren't there for more than 6 months, but I definitely had a French accent because we were there, and I started school there. And then when we moved to London, I was an American with a French accent, so the last thing they wanted was me to speak like that in their school. So I took elocution lessons after school, this kind of beehive preparatory school. Back then they had the 11 pluses, whether you went to the factory or went to be educated, right? And that was that one test that they prepared you for. So they had these rich kid schools that you had to be born into. But of course, Dr. Nelson's son and daughter had to go to one of those schools, I guess. I don't know. So I wore short pants, had a blazer, a little satchel, my little hat, and I spoke the Queen's English. That's why a lot of British people think that I'm making fun of them when I talk to them for a while. But when you're trained as a kid to speak like that, it just comes back naturally. If I were to be over there for a period of time, it probably would come back. But it got beat out of me coming back to the States. Brian. Hey, Kumi. Say hi, Brian.
Kumi. Sachi Budi.
Sachi Budi. She's been wonderful lately, boy.
Lately?
Yeah.
Wasn't she always wonderful?
Yeah, I mean, but she's been really... A person needs to die more often to get this sort of attention. Yeah, it's great, you know. Oh, I might lose Robert. Oh, good. She's so funny, man. I'll tell you. She's amazing. Anyway, enough about her. Let's talk about me.
Yes.
Me!
Yes. So you grew up in England.
I mean, I went to, like, equivalent of second grade over there and made the first couple of years of school over here really easy. And my sister...
That was back in Baltimore?
No, we went to New Haven, Connecticut. My dad, I don't know what he did at Yale, but he had a bunch of students by that time. And then after that, he got hired by Howard Hughes to start the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, HHMI, which started in 1960, I believe. And my father was a senior investigator for that. And he did more of his research, and we moved to Coral Gables, Florida.
How did you get into juggling to begin with?
Well, I mean, no one taught me how to juggle. I saw a friend of mine.
Well, that's obvious from your wacky five-ball.
Oh, reverse, right. I think my very first time I saw somebody was Donald Chang. We were supposed to study for a test, and we were seniors in high school, and we were just studying for a long period of time, and we were over at my friend Alan Weiss's house, and he was kind of an athlete. He had a little weight room and all kinds of bats and balls and tennis equipment and a big basket. And Don went in there, and while we were just so bored with ourselves, and pulled out three balls and just juggled them for a second. And I didn't even think too much of it. But within several weeks after that, I was in my front yard and my dog was chewing on a tennis ball. And I noticed there were two other chewed up tennis balls there as well. My father used to play tennis, you know, a lot. And anyway, I took him inside, washed him off, and went into my room and taught myself how to juggle. Obviously the wrong way, the reverse cascade as opposed to the regular cascade. And that, going out and showing the kids in the neighborhood that I did that, I went from being the dorkiest kid in the neighborhood to, wow, look at what he can do, you know. So I got a lot of attention for that, and I think that just went to my head, and I liked feeling special, so I continued on with the juggling.
So you learned to juggle from your jock friend from your...
Well, he wasn't really a jock friend, but yeah, he was a bit of an athlete. I guess you're right. But when I went to FSU, the interesting part was, you know, you're in a dormitory for the first year. You're required to live in it, and you're with a bunch of guys, and my social skills were pretty poor.
No.
Yeah, they were pretty bad. I guess they still are. But I taught a lot of the kids to juggle, and it somehow got around to one of the jugglers at the FSU circus, Dickie Brinson's partner, and he says, oh, we need a juggler. Why don't you come by the circus? And he just left a note on my door. And President Kennedy had a mandatory physical education program, and circus skills would satisfy one of those prerequisites. So I took it on a lark, thinking I could juggle. And I tell you, I was really introduced to some amazing things while I was there. The ability of those people and their technical expertise and their dedication to the circus skills themselves was just a real inspiration to me. I actually did a show there, and he brought all the circus students and gave me a circus patch, which I treasure to this day, because I never really earned it. You know, that FSU circus patch? You have to...
Is that for going through the program or something?
No, no. I went through the program, and I was in the circus itself, which really meant just show up after class and work your ass off most of the time. And I did rigging for the shows, but I never was a performer in the shows, except for helping spot people and stuff like that. But to get a circus patch, you had to be a performer and work in Callaway Gardens over the summer. And only really good acts got that. And I could juggle, but I didn't have much of an act at all. I assisted people while I was FSU. But the fact that Dickie gave it to me later on and presented it to me, it really was quite an honor.
So this was late 60s.
Well, I had already transferred down from FSU. I think I went to FSU until the beginning of my sophomore year, and then I transferred down to University of Florida in Gainesville, mostly because I wanted to meet girls. I was still a freshman virgin in college, you know, fresh from high school and not good with girls. And the University of Florida got nominated number one in the nation in sexual permissiveness. So I put a transfer in that same afternoon. I read it. And I went from a biology major to a chemistry major, presumably because I had to have some sort of valid reason for changing. I don't know. It was just so well. I went down there on my motorcycle in the pouring rain, and I had sex within 6 days after showing up there. And it never stopped. I just got one girl after another. It was just amazing sexual freedom of the late 60s, and that school was so progressive, and even a quiet little virgin seemed to do well down there. I don't know. I probably shouldn't have left. No, it was kind of my awakening time. That was a really kind of cool time. And again, the juggling went with me, and that's when I started doing it to music, you know. For all the people in the neighborhood, they'd come over to my place. I put my little black lights on. And I juggled to Black Magic Woman by Santana. I was really good at that one. And then the, oh gosh, what else? You know, Shaft or something like that. Here Comes the Sun was the first song I ever juggled to music to. It just came on and balls started bouncing around in the air in front of me. I didn't have much control over it. It was kind of funny to see them doing what they were doing. So I just didn't sat back and enjoyed it, and that's it sort of took off. So I didn't know, you know, how to make a living at it, that's for sure. But that's why I moved to New Orleans to see if I could. And I didn't have any promo, I had nothing. I just showed up in the town and didn't even have a place to stay.
And why did you think, let's go to New Orleans and street?
I don't know. I just heard the name on songs, you know, that I'd heard on the radio. There was always this magical town, New Orleans. I don't know. You know, you just hear a name of a town. It sounded very romantic, and that's why I decided to go there. And I ended up...
Showed up, there was a scene?
There was a busking scene down at Jackson Square, but no jugglers, just musicians. And after a frustrating couple of days of not getting anybody to hire me anywhere, most of them just looked at me like I was nuts. I remember that. I ended up feeling pretty dejected. I remember I said, well, I've got to juggle for somebody tonight. So I grab my tennis balls and I go walking down. I think it was Dauphine Street or maybe it was Bourbon. I'm not sure. And I just walked into one of these little bars because I heard a song being played on the jukebox. And it was Elton John, right? And I just said, well, I can juggle to that. I'm going to do it for somebody. Somebody's got to see what I can do. So I go in there and I juggle to this song. And as soon as I finish, I look up. I'm looking at the balls. I wasn't looking at the audience. It was a gay bar, and I didn't know that. And the guy comes up and he goes, if you're not going to buy anything, you have to get out. And I was so freaked out and stunned by that moment. And when I went out the door, there was this street performer that I saw in Jackson Square earlier that day with a black hat. And I had a black hat. And he had a feather in his hat. And he had this pretty blonde girl with him. He had his guitar over his shoulder. And he says, "You want to come to the wrong place?" And I kind of said, "I think I just was in the wrong place." And he just takes me to this bar where all these singer-songwriters hung out, called the wrong place, on the corner of Governor Nichols and Rampart. Wasn't far from there anyway. And I lived on Dauphine, on 1130 Dauphine Street. I had just gotten an apartment there right after that. Or in fact, that's when I started looking in that neighborhood for one. I was sleeping in my car for a couple of days. So anyway, those people introduced me to the world of singers and songwriters and artists, and it was just the most amazing group of people in this small little bar. And there, you know, Leather just died about a year ago, but he brought me into this world of true artists, people really believing in what they were doing. And I believed in what I was doing. It's just that, I don't know, I didn't know how to make a living doing it. But I think it was definitely their influence that kept me going. And I did my first busking down on Canal Street with Henry the Fiddler.
He was very tall, and he had this long hair, and he had this rainbow outfit, and he was just a force to be reckoned with when he would walk into a room. And the only other person I saw with that kind of power was my own father, you know, when he would walk, I'm scared to death. So Henry, he actually walked into this room full of musicians that I was hanging around with, guitar players that worked in Jackson Square. He goes, "Anybody in here play music?" You know, which was a real insult because they were all musicians. He knew who they all were. They all knew who he was, what an arrogant asshole he was. And I stood up. Everybody else was so intimidated by it because he was so good with the violin. And, you know, they were good pickers and songwriters, but they certainly weren't the musician he was. And so I stood up with my little juggling balls. And he gives me this glare, you know, this steel glare, and this black hair with his headband. And, oh, God, you scary human being, you. And he starts tuning up his thing. So I started picking my balls, you know. And I said, "Do you know the William Tell Overture? You know, it's a classical piece. You're going to have to be a damn good musician to play the Lone Ranger theme, right?" And no problem with him. So while he was doing it, I started juggling in time to his, you know, I was the musical juggler in 72, oh God, or bluegrass juggler in Nashville. How embarrassing. But that's what I did. That was my kick. You know, I didn't talk or anything. I certainly didn't have a character. And we ended up going out on Canal Street, and he made hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars with me juggling next to him, and he would give me $20 at the end of the day.
About 3 months later, a hurricane was going to come through, and they shut down the wrong place. Charlie Blue took off, and I took off too, and beat the hurricane back to Gainesville and finished up school and eventually went to Nashville. And
so if that hurricane hadn't come?
I probably would have gone back home. I don't know what I would have done. Maybe I'd be a singer-songwriter by now. I don't know. If the hurricane hadn't come, that's a good question.
But you had gone there thinking, "I'm going to stay."
No, I still had my apartment back there. You know, I had all my stuff back in Gainesville. I had an apartment, and all my stuff was there. I mean, not that it was that much. You know, back then, I think it was a couch I found on the street.
But you hadn't just said, "Okay, I'm moving."
No, I didn't. You just
went there
with a bunch of pot.
Then went back to school.
Yeah.
And then went up to Vanderbilt.
Right, exactly. And the whole time I was back, I would try to get little gigs at Rathskeller. I'd hang out with musicians and juggle with them. Even in Gainesville, my dream was to be a juggler, but not necessarily a comedy juggler or a talking juggler.
You had yet to go to the juggling convention. You had yet to see.
I had never seen another juggler, really. When I was at Vanderbilt, I had a girl who was a med student. I teach the med students how to do this machine, this chromatography machine, HPLC, high pressure liquid chromatography. And one of my students was this girl, and she saw the juggling stuff next to my desk, and she goes, "Oh, my brother juggles." You know, you typical Yeah, sure they do. Nobody's as good as me, you know, because by this time I could do four balls, for God's sakes. And I never
what
saw.
What year was this?
1972, three, four. Yeah, I think it was 72 when she came up to me. And the interesting part about that was that Doug Kershaw, the Cajun fiddler, was having a free concert on the lawn, and I went out there. And like I did around town, I stood up and juggled in the front when he was fiddling. And, you know, I wasn't expecting to get paid. I just hoped not to get thrown out. But it was such a relaxed situation that it was cool that I did it. And right after it was over, there's this guy standing there. And he goes, oh, my name's Carter Andrews. And I said, well, I'm pleased to meet you. He goes, you're pretty good with those three balls. And I said, well, thank you very much. And he goes, do you do four? And I said, yeah, I do. And I was really proud of myself. And I showed him a few four-ball moves. We're over on the side by this time. And he goes, oh, yeah, do you do five? And I said, no, nobody can do five. And he takes the five balls out, and he flashes them in front of my eyes. And I just couldn't believe this guy could just juggle five balls. And I followed him back to his dorm room. He was at Vanderbilt. And that was that med student's younger brother, who was also going to Vandy. And he had to leave almost the next day to go to Europe for like a student exchange thing over there for a year. So he was gone for the next year. And in that year, I tried so desperately to learn five balls the way he had showed me with the regular cascade. And I just couldn't do it. And one night I was so frustrated. I just remember going into my room all alone in Nashville. You know, I was still at Vanderbilt twiddling test tins during the day. And then I go home and I practice this juggling at night, you know. And I threw all five of them up, but I threw them up in a reverse instead of a regular. And I caught them all the very first time I did it. And I was just astounded. And then I just did it again, and I got a good, decent run because I was so good with three already that going to five and doing it the way I normally did it just worked so much better. And I just, boom, within a couple hours, I had a decent run with five balls in a reverse cascade. And it took me years before I learned how to do a regular cascade with it. And then Carter took me to my first IJA convention.
When was that?
1975. In Youngstown, Ohio, in a, gosh, it was a YMCA, and I remember walking in and looking at all these real jugglers. Now, mind you, Carter was the only one juggler I'd ever seen besides myself. And I walk into this room full of amazing jugglers, and I remember just bursting out in tears. I had my trombone case full of different colored tennis balls. this is rhinestone hat on and denim shirt with a butterfly embroidered. My mother did a bunch of shirts for me and a semi-looking cowboy. But I wasn't a redneck, you know. I'd only been in Nashville for a couple of years.
You were an academic. You were a scientist, right?
Yeah, but I did. I guess
you was it like your hobby thing or something, or you know, juggling? And
I was already. That's all I thought about every day. I mean, you're not supposed to be in a profession that
you're thinking about other
you're
shit.
Thinking about other shit, especially when people's lives are in danger. And one day, the honest answer is we had a guy die. And the results that I had given for the dosage that was recommended, I had given too low a number. My columns, this thing, technical thing, it absorbed too much of the control, so I had a lower reading for his everybody has a different metabolic rate, you know, so I get a little blood in the morning, I run through things, and it was an experimental drug to begin with, but that being said, the guy passed away. And I was brought into this room where I was vindicated. You know, they said, well, this is a technical problem that you're not responsible for. It does happen occasionally. A column goes bad, absorbs too much of the drug. That's just the name of the game. That's why they've changed the technology since. But that was okay with them, but it wasn't okay with me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would go to work each day. And I have my little desk over there and my little thing over on the other side of the wall, and I'd do my little testing, but I had my juggling balls next to the desk, or, you know, be this Diablo or something there, you know, that I was always thinking about. And I remember washing my own glassware in the morning and thinking about whatever new trick I could come up with. And I wasn't thinking about what I was doing. And when I went home, I remember that evening, I said, you know, you're just trying to be like your father. You know, you're trying to walk in his footsteps. You don't have the intellectual chops to do that. And you're at a stage now where you're responsible for other people's well-being. And something happened here. And even though they sort of forgave me or indemnified me because of a technical mistake, I don't think I did myself. So it just happened that I got a notice in the mail. Your audition for Opryland is going to be on such
Opryland.
And I went, I never applied. You know?
Opryland?
Opryland was a small amusement park in Nashville. So this audition comes in front of me. I juggle to music. Now I have switched from not just bluegrass, so I'm also doing classical music, but there's no verbal stuff going on between me and the crowd. It's just juggling to the music. So I'm supposed to show up at a certain date. Now my friend Carter Andrews, there's no way this guy's going to take a whole summer off and do it. I don't know why he was doing it, but he went in there on a 6-foot unicycle and juggled 5 softballs while he was up there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And all I got is 3 balls.
Wow.
But I got my black lights. I got patchwork bib overalls, theater full of people who are all are going to audition themselves, and the little panel in front of you, right? Or 4 or 5 people. I don't even know who they were. Well, I heard this crash while I was juggling to the music, you know? It's during one of the bluegrass numbers, Foggy Mountain Breakdown, I think it was. And apparently the guy had fallen off his seat. He had just went, like, whoa, bam, and falling down. But I didn't know. So the lights come back on, and there everybody is crazy. The room, the energy, it was like we'd never seen anything like this before in our lives. Come on over here right now. We're not waiting to the end. We want to talk to you right now. So I walk over, and I'm standing up. In these,
how old are you?
I must have been 23. Anyway, the guy says, you ride a unicycle? And I went, yeah.
But you didn't, huh?
No, Carter had one. I knew that.
It looked easy.
It wasn't. But I had to learn it before my first day. But the interesting thing was, because I was a chemist, I had sent away for this patent that American Cyanamid had with the glow sticks, the glow stuff. They were just putting in necklaces,
oh, yeah.
And it was just the green stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was the early, early days.
Right,
it was
wow,
before they
yeah.
had the sticks or anything. And they were just this
now.
Guy, and they'd pour it into a tank, and they'd dip these things in and hand them out to you, and you strap them around your neck. Well, I wanted to make balls that did that, so I didn't have to carry these lights around with me.
Yeah,
so I had a guy blow some glass balls for me, and I put a septum in them. And I would inject them with the fluorescer. So these balls would glow. And I kept them in a flute case.
They were glass,
and all my, yeah, they were glass.
Wow.
And they would leak because the peroxide, when it activates, and it expands. So anything would leak out and it'd leak and it'd be really hard as shit to juggle. So they never really worked out, but what an eye catcher.
Yeah.
You know, so. Could you turn the lights out for a second? Then I go,
wow.
And I've got 5 different colors of glowing liquid in front of these guys. And they're looking at me. Not only this guy just knocked our socks off with this musical juggling, he's some sort of fucking wizard.
Yeah.
You know, he's making light out of liquid in front of us. And they had never seen anything like that before. So I got hired, and then I had to learn the unicycle and a very short period of time, and as you guys know, you can learn how to ride it before you can learn to rock on it.
Yeah.
And I rode it through the crowds, and luckily there were enough people that I could grab a hold of. I had this idea in my head that I was going to be a sexy juggler, handsome, you know. Probably the only juggler I ever saw was Francis Braun on TV, and I don't even remember that, but he was kind of cool and sexy. So I envisioned that. And someone said, you know, a lot of the guys are gay. I didn't even know what gay was. He says, well, they don't like girls. And I said, well, that's good. I do. So I go out there, and the outfit they put me in is literally, the hat was 3 feet high. A dunce cap, 3 feet high. And it had these big balls on it, and I had these ruffly things with ruffle and short pants with my skinny little legs with red and white.
So funny.
And they made 3 costumes for me, one to wear, one in laundry, and one to stand by if something was ripped.
Wow.
And so I bust out in this show. I guess our circus show, we had a monkey, a cat. It was really lame. And that's why it got canceled. The cat would never jump through the fiery hoop. The monkey ran up a tree and ran away constantly. They were always trying to get it down. The bird that was supposed to fly from the back and land on the stage would land on the wire and take a shit. And then the clown would bust through these doors and juggle to the William Tell Overture. Just a short little ditty to it. And then I'd be gone. Well, I was the only thing that worked in the whole show, and consistently was entertaining and didn't shit on the stage. And the monkey actually attacked me one day, just bursting through the doors. It was right there. And so anyway, they called us on to the office after 1 week. Now, mind you, I had left my job to do this. And now I'm getting fired after 1 week. You know, I'm pretty bad shape here. What am I going to do to eat? And so actually one of the smartest things I did in my life is when they called the whole show in, including the band, and fired them, I just sat in the back and didn't say a word. And I waited and I said, I'd like to talk to you sometime if you're available, you know, on a more personal note. He says, well, let's do it now. We got rid of them. I'm going to get rid of you. And when I speak, I don't really come across as being stupid. And he says, well, he doesn't sound like he's an idiot. He says, okay, you know what? We'll keep you on for another 2 weeks because we already have the costume. You'll be a roving clown. Total carte blanche to go and do where I want. So in those 2 weeks, it was just heaven. I would get on this unicycle and I would go to the country music show right when I knew a certain song they were going to play that I could juggle to. Because, you know, you got to know the park. You're there all day long. And the bluegrass show right when they do Foggy Mountain Breakdown. Any of the outdoor shows. I couldn't obviously go into the indoor. But most of them were outdoor shows. And when I wasn't doing that, I'd do it for the kids.
They were just roving around and doing juggling.
Yeah, with the other rover. There was one rover there. Now, this rover was a ringling clown, redneck from Memphis named Joe, did not like me at all, usurping his authority. He carried a big old hot dog around one day, or a big old baseball bat with a big glove. You know, he was just a clown that walked around. Shake hands, yeah. And
why don't you do something like that other guy? He juggles and rides a unicycle.
Oh, he hated that, you know, and I didn't know. And Mr. I want to be an artist in everything I do. My makeup, I would meticulously put on these amazing peaks and things in the mouth. And, and it just worked, you know. Ooh. I was really good at it and the makeup and everything. And I would spend hours doing it because I didn't have to go out until my makeup was on. No schedule, rock and roll. And you go backstage as a clown, you'll like this. And in, say, the country music show, and these were pretty girls. Talented, but a lot of them were beautiful, too. And they had to do quick changes. And they just did not have time for modesty. They would just come off the stage. They rip their clothes off and then throw their other costume because they had to go Tammy Wynette costume and wig, and then Loretta Lynn one, and I would just sit back there and watch them dress and undress as a clown, and they just didn't even think anything of it, you know. A little perverted, I guess. I love that. A bit voyeuristic. But I ended up being very popular with the girls. Real popular with the girls. I mean, I'm not popular as, you know, maybe a
good-looking guy or somebody who was a musician, but... And they said, what's your name? And I said, I don't know, Butterfly. I don't know what the fuck. You know, I had him on my shirt. I had him on my pants from my love interest from that went bad years ago. During those 2 weeks, I was only supposed to have 2 weeks, but I think it was the day or 2 days before my end of my contract, which, like I said, was 3 weeks in total. But Opryland was going to continue to the end of the summer. And I thought that I was going to have at least a job for a couple more months. But a guy named Huell Hauser, who interviews people probably still today, was a beginning newscaster for Channel 5 and happened to be visiting Opryland on a very rainy day. And, you know, I was paid anyway. I didn't care if the costume got wet. I just would ride around in the rain and go to wherever people were huddled. And he happened to be huddled next to a guitar player that was outside tuning up. And I went to this little group and this guy went, and I went, and he just was looking at me like, what are you all about? And I'm like,
and you have that
Oh, yeah. And the makeup, mind you, I was pretty young, so I wasn't crusty.
Right.
I've never been a handsome, but Huell Hauser, and I found out later,
not to be crusty.
Very gay. Very, very gay. And I looked very, very gay. Now, whether he and Butterfly the Clown, right? And while he comes out with a whole news crew and they did this human interest story that aired, and he finishes off the interview on the thing, he goes, so come out for the rest of the summer to Opryland and see Butterfly the Clown, right? So next morning I'm called into the office. You're here to the end of the summer. You're not going anywhere. Yes, sir. And after that was over, somebody said you should go on unemployment, which I did for a little while. But, you know, I only worked for a year or two, so they don't give you extended benefits. You can do it for like a few weeks. And I delivered phone books and still trying to do those open mics. That's where I met Jim Varney, Vern, and he kind of tried to convince me to keep going at it. It was a little rough. So I had heard about street performing by that time. And one of the most embarrassing things that I had to do to just eat, because I was not going to go back to Vanderbilt. I still had hair. I was balding, but I didn't have a butterfly. Mm. Was to do what's known as a waiter, costumed waiter. You could be a different character. You know, the Groucho Marx, Lucille Ball, whatever you could do. And I said, well, I'll be a juggler. I'll just be myself. And I was very, I used to have a good mind that I could memorize when they ordered something. I didn't really have to write it down. I could memorize. And I never made mistakes. And I was very conscientious about that. So I was a good waiter and I got moved from lunches to dinners. And then it only lasted just a couple of weeks because I kept looking at the calendar and I knew there was this thing called Mardi Gras. And I said, well, I'm just going to go down there and I'm going to put a hat out on the street. And mind you, when you're just a musical juggler and you haven't been vocal and you can't bring any music because there's no such thing as an iPod or nothing. I just went to New Orleans and I said, I'm going to go do it. And then I stayed at this Christian family's home. And when I was staying with them in Slidell, I didn't have the tattoo. I went there with hair. And then the next night I come back and I'm drunk and I got a half a butterfly on the back of my head because the tattooist said she wouldn't do it anymore because I kept puking, right? And I'm like this and somehow made it home with a half a butterfly on the back, not even colored in, just the outline. And the next morning I got it done and then filled in and then the front one done and filled in all in one fell swoop, so...
But did you already go bald or you just shaved it?
I shaved it. I just took
just
it off.
Just thought, oh, you'll put it there because...
Well, yeah, it'll hide it. You can always hide it, you know? Good place to put a tattoo.
Yeah, know? But...
Didn't really turn out that way, did it?
No.
And I went down there and there's this group next to me that I had recognized. Locomotion, Bounce, and Cyrus. And they're gleaming, handsome, cut bodies with these zigzag unicycles and these great acrobatics. And I'm just looking at them, and I didn't even think. I said, well, as soon as they're done, I'm going to start. As soon as they finished, though, it just was instinct. It was the right thing to do because they walked over from that show. And enough of them just looking at me because the butterfly was brand new, fresh, kind of swollen, you know. And I just got it like a couple of days before and had taken the Vaseline off. So it was still real tender up there. It was brand new. And I'm going to be this. I don't know. Enough of this trying to be like my dad. There's no turning back now, motherfucker. Damn. You got a butterfly on your head. Yeah, it was basically
balls to the wall. That's the first you see locomotion.
And they were just like awesome. And they didn't intimidate me at all. It was life.
And then what'd you do? So you didn't have music, so what?
I could do five balls, and I had bocce balls, so I threw all five in the air. And the good thing about juggling five balls is you don't have to look at anybody. You can keep it going for a while. You can just, you know. So I started talking. I think the first thing I said, I learned how to do this in my garage. After my sister locked me in there. She was on her motorcycle when she used to rev it up, and I was just making up anything. But he said it in a way that was kind of like nasally. You know how I am, kind of nasally. And somebody yelled something at me, like, you know, "Yeah, you fucking whatever, weirdo." And I just, you know, went back, and then it was pre-Mardi Gras. These people are drunk, and they started heckling me, and I just went right back at them because, you know, I grew up insecure. I had a friend of mine who was real quick-witted, and he used to pick on me all the time. So eventually I ended up learning how to kind of maybe not physically fight, but verbally fight him back. I certainly had all the material that he used to deprecate me with, you know, that really ground in. So I ended up just throwing that stuff back at him. And the crowd just became electrified. The very first performance, I think I made $150. First time on the street, it was like, whoa, my God, how did I do so well? You know, I never understood how I came up with stuff. Just sort of my mind works very, very well on stage. It's only off stage that I get tongue-tied. But when I'm in front of people, I guess it's the fear that causes the adrenaline to rush. And everything seems to be very clear, and I always can figure out the right thing to say. I remember going home at the end of that day, and I had all of this money in my backpack because I would just dump it into a sack. I was just immediately successful with it after that first day bounce came up after the sixth show I did. I mean, I can't really call them shows, can I? But I'd finish with a fireman's hat and juggling three fire torches and screaming. I don't remember what I did. You know. Somebody put a picture, though, in my hat, a Polaroid, and I still have that to this day of the very first day. And Bounce, you know, how Bounce is. He's such a wonderful human being. And why don't you come over to the truck? You know, they had this Econolot van with all these ladders and ropes and juggling pins and so professional and everything. And I'm like, he goes, you know, you look a little tired. He gave me a wet cloth to clean him, and he gave me some juice and Cyrus tried to sell me a t-shirt.
I mean, Bounce just took me under his wing my very first day as a busker. And hell, I was his competition. I was performing right next to them. I had no idea who they were. All I knew is that they had this huge crowd around them and that they were obviously very good at what they did. And I was 100% green. I had never done any show talking before. I had juggled to music before, but I had never spoken to a crowd.
But when you get a laugh, and I had gotten a laugh before I had gone down there one time. I was on at the exit in, and I remember I had a Wallensack reel-to-reel. And I would have to bring that in. It's a portable one, a little handle. And I'd bring it in, and they'd hook it up to their sound system for this, they call it Writer's Night. It was open mic for guitar players and singers and songwriters. And me and Jim Varney would do it. He would try out his new comedy bit, and I'd come up with some new thing that I was going to juggle to, right? We'd spend all week. I'd spend all week thinking, oh, what am I going to do next Wednesday night? I'm not getting paid, but I'm so excited about it, right? And then I put something together, and I went in there, and I had my tape. And the guy, because I'm the juggler, he's not interested in watching the juggler. He's waiting for the next famous star, country music star, to show up, the guy who runs the sound. And he wanted to get high. And he knew he wouldn't have to do anything except turn the thing on and leave. So he turns it on when I'm going to do my little six-minute thing and runs in the back to smoke a joint. Well, right in the middle of it, because I had spliced it myself, one of the splices just broke. So I've got no music. And I'm a musical juggler with no fucking music. And I'm standing there alone. There's nobody in the sound booth. Nobody. I'm on stage alone with my balls in my hand, literally. Oh, and this guy yells out, "Do something." No, I don't remember what I said, but my timing was good. I had to say something real quick. God, I wish I could go back in time to remember whatever it was, because whatever I said, the whole place just exploded in laughter, which made me feel great. You know, all of a sudden you're in panic, and then everybody's approving you, laughter and approving. And I said, well, I'm going to try to do comedy. And I was a bit of a reader, and so I would memorize little passages about this, that, and the other that were weird. And it was a very strange moment in my life, because I was talking to people in between things about really strange stuff, about hot dogs, about watches, cockroaches. None of it had punchline. Some of it didn't even make any sense because I would forget pieces of it, you know. I had no clue. I didn't know. My girlfriend at the time, she goes, you know, a lot of people think you're gay. And I went, why would they think that? No, I'm not.
This never crossed your mind before?
No, never, never. And I'm wearing tights with these hip boots and bells, and I thought, well, it worked. I think to be buskers initially, everybody sort of has to grab whatever they can grab that they have. I happen to have a jester's costume that somebody had made to do Mule Day in Columbia, Tennessee. This family of clowns had made me a jester's outfit to juggle in the parade with them on my unicycle. This is way before I was professional. And I had that. So I had that, and I had this colorful belt with a butterfly on it. I wore that. Had these boots with butterflies on them. I wore that. I mean, that's what I had, right? I think maybe the outer attire is somewhat of a reflection of a direction that you end up going. You know, I don't know. I ended up being kind of this jester-esque individual, a bouncy, and butterfly man. I mean, it's like, he doesn't sound like he's an aggressive comic.
No, not at all.
Sounds like a sweetheart, right?
Yeah, he's the antithesis of that.
Right,
yeah, maybe
right.
That's part of the magic.
Before going into our regular closing credits for today's podcast, we have a special announcement to make. In the beginning, the Busker Hall of Fame name was just that, a name, a sort of grandiose title to slap on our attempts to capture the essence of the world of street performing. Today, that changes. To pay tribute to the guy who helped cook up this idea and to acknowledge an incredible life and body of work associated with street arts, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to announce that Robert Nelson, the Butterfly Man, has been selected to become the inaugural inductee to the Busker Hall of Fame. Officially decreed on this first day of April 2013, April Fool's Day. If Robert were still with us, he might have something like this to say when being given this recognition.
First of all, we have to welcome everyone to this momentous occasion.
Now, a guy like me, I never took it seriously at all.
You know, I'll be honest, it just the whole thing has been quite a ride. I'm so much a part of that world, and I get so much from it, too.
What I miss most of all, I think, is the laughter and the applause. Well, thank you so much.
Robert's name will be the first to be added to a special sculpture being created by street artist Rachel Peters to acknowledge the contributions he brought to our circle. Stories from the Pitch is produced by the Busker Hall of Fame. Music for today's podcast came from Hokum W. Jeeb's Piano a la Carte CD. Special thanks to Hokum's estate for allowing us to use his music. Subscribe to this podcast via iTunes. Just go into the Music Store's podcast section and search for Stories from the Pitch. If you like what you're listening to, please do leave a review in iTunes as it helps with our rankings and visibility. Do you want to help make this project better? Do you have music that you'd be willing to let us use? Advice on how to improve our website or content we're putting out? Are you a potential sponsor who would like to be associated with this project? If so, we want to hear from you. Drop me a line at cbg@buskerhalloffame.com. None of those options apply to you? Well, then consider picking up a Busker Hall of Fame t-shirt. Proceeds from these shirts help to cover the ongoing costs of maintaining this project. Full ordering details can be found at buskerhalloffame.com. We also have loads of additional content on our Facebook page at facebook.com/buskerhalloffame. Has this episode reminded you of a great Butterfly Man story? We're still collecting memories for another episode about some of the crazy hijinks that Robert got up to during his career, so if you've got a story and could share it with us, please call the Butterfly Hotline at 1-416-613-0003 and share it with us. There's no question that Robert brought something special to the streets when he pursued his love of juggling and performing, but his mother couldn't quite let go of what she thought her son was capable of.
Oh, Bobby, you could have been at least a dentist. I love my mom saying that one. You could have been at least a dentist.
Special thanks to all the people involved with the recordings we used for today's episode. Pee-wee Murray, Brian Halse, Henrik, Woodhead, Dave Rave, Fritz Brehm, Dave Altman, and Lindsay Lindberg. Huge thanks also to the staff of the Busker Hall of Fame who helped mine for the golden moments in these recordings. On behalf of myself and co-producer Lindsay Lindberg, we hope this finds you well, and as you perform for audiences around the world, please remember to use your superpowers for good. I'm David Aiken, the Checkerboard Guy. Thanks for listening.
Wow. What a beautiful trophy.